This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The major buzz surrounding the recent film Boyhood was that it took 12 years to film as they followed the lead character as the actor playing him grew up. Now, along comes a documentary that has taken even longer, or will take even longer, to make. Filmmaker Noah Hutton has spent 6 years, I believe, following the progress of the Human Brain Project, which will take 15 years to complete. Ultimately, it will result in his film The Blue Brain Project, detailing scientists' attempts to map the human brain to create a biologically accurate virtual model of the brain. Director, writer, composer, and documentarian Noah Hutton will share some clips from his work in progress and share details of the progress of the project itself as part of CPCC's Sensoria Arts Festival, and he joins us in advance of his appearance there on April the 14th. Thanks for being with us this morning. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
And in the studio, we've invited Dr. Tony Asher to shed more light on the brain. Dr. Asher is the director of the Adult Brain Tumor Program at the Levine Cancer Institute at Carolina's healthcare system and at Presbyterian Hospital, which of course is operated by Novant. And he is also co-medical director of the Neuroscience Institute at Carolina's healthcare system. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Noah, let's start with you. As a filmmaker, what got you interested enough in the human brain and the Human Brain Project to devote 15 years of your life to having a finished product to show for your efforts?
15 years is a long time. It was supposed to be 10 when I started. Now it's been lengthened once already. It might be more, but what got me interested to begin with was I finished college and I looked around at the world and I felt like we were living in a time that was, I guess the only parallel I could think of was the early 20th century with physics in terms of the prominence of a new emerging field in science, a great unknown in front of us, and the amount of buzz at that time from the 90s on, I think, has surrounded neuroscience as that great unknown. I think quantum physics and neuroscience are sort of the two great abysses of science right now that we're pushing into. So I finished college and I wanted to make films, and I thought, how could you make a film about neuroscience at this juncture? So I looked around and there was this 10-year project starting, and I thought, you can't make a film about a 10-year project in 1 or 2 years as I'd usually do. So you really have to follow the timeline of the project with the timeline of your film.
Well, you know, you come from an artsy family, so I guess it makes sense that you become a filmmaker, but you also have had, I understand, this interest in neuroscience. I think it started with in college, maybe. Is that when it started?
Yeah, absolutely. As an undergraduate, I took an intro course and I did get hooked. Yeah,
and you didn't really know how to tie that together with your artistic bent. And I'm told that you and a writer named Ben Ehrlich started an online magazine called The Beautiful Brain.
That's right. Yeah, it's thebeautifulbrain.com. That's right. We still write for it, and that site is an attempt to link art and neuroscience. We've been doing that since 2009. We interview people, we write essays, and we're looking for that kind of Renaissance spirit that was around in the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, but has seemed to have gone missing in this highly specialized world we live in today.
So are you interested in the brain and in science about the brain more because of the potential for breakthroughs that we're witnessing now in medicine, throughout medicine, and particularly in this field? Or are you more interested in the brain in terms of how it works to make creativity happen?
You know, I'm equally interested in both, because at the root of it, I'm just interested in this thing, the brain. I think that it is the seat of diseases, but you know, there's a lot of people we feature on our website, for example, who have had tumors or strokes, and then have that process, when they've recovered from it, has opened up some of the most creative years of their life. They become artists. They used to be lawyers, and this link between disease and creativity, just to mention it, is one fascinating one that we've been investigating with the website. So all these things get connected in interesting ways.
You said you have an Apollo 13 theory of neuroaesthetics. You want to explain that to us?
Yeah, well, very briefly, I've been frustrated by there's a lot of talk in this field. Often people think that neuroscience is an answer now for these deep questions of art and these mysteries of creativity and why we are drawn to art, why we make art. So there's been a lot of backlash, too, because people look at these news articles where they have a colorful image from an fMRI scanner of the brain, and they say, here's the X area of the brain, here's the love area, here's the creativity area. And as if that's an end domain, as if that can explain something right now, where really we're just at the beginning of our understanding. So I came up with this thing called the Apollo 13 theory, where what I think we need to do more of right now is to use neuroscience and the insights that are coming out of it as not a moon that we land on, but rather, as the Apollo 13 mission did, unfortunately they had to, you get very close to it, you get intimate with it to give yourself some velocity, that slingshot effect. You loop around it to get back to the domain you want to talk to, which is, you know, whether it's art or creativity, whatever you want to get to, you use it as a booster, not as somewhere you land on for an end-all explanation.
Because there's nowhere to land, or because we can't land there yet because we don't have the technology.
There might be somewhere to land at some point once we have enough of a enough complexity in our discourse. But at the moment, I think we don't have the fuel to land and take off again, where there's nowhere to land.
So let me bring a neuroscientist into this, Dr. Tony Asher from Carolina's Healthcare and Presbyterian Hospital. Would that be accurate? Is that a good analogy of where we are in terms of research and development of in your field?
Well, I would say that we understand some things very well. Mm-hmm. The ambition that I think Noah is looking at here, the broader idea of understanding the complex interactions that occur in the brain in the most detailed ways. I mean, that's a pretty lofty goal. But we do know tremendous amounts about some of these basic functions and where they reside in the brain, and those can inform a lot of what we do. It certainly informs what we do every day in terms of treating individual patients. And I would say that we use most of that information right now to, if you will, stealthily go into those complex interconnected systems, try and treat disease focally and leave those systems intact as best we can. That's the challenge for neuroscientists who are involved more on the therapeutic side.
We know a lot about kidneys. We know a lot about the heart. We know a lot about the lungs, I suppose. We know a lot about other systems in the body. But we don't know as much, I don't think, maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, about the brain, and probably that is because we've not been able to study the brain until really recently while a person is alive. Would that be accurate?
That's exactly right. There are a variety of different challenges. You know, first is just the sheer complexity. I mean, the number of neurons, the number of potential connections is just almost an unimaginable number of ways that the parts of the system can interact. But for example, techniques such as functional MRI imaging right now, which are readily available. It's just astounding to think that in any major hospital right now, a patient could have an image that allows us to see an area of the brain lighting up when they talk, when they move. We know where those centers are. And moreover, the major fiber pathways, not, again, some of the things that Noah has been documenting at the cellular or even molecular level, but at least the major cables, if you will, connecting these different areas. We can see those. We can see it on a scan. And so if you superimpose someone's disease, let's say it's a tumor, we can see the areas of activation when somebody is moving an arm. We can see how that area is connected to another area of the brain. And we can avoid those very critical pathways when we're trying to treat that disease.
But the brain is more – I read this yesterday. I know nothing about this. The brain is more complex than even the most complex supercomputers, and it runs on the power of a light bulb. So that tells me that we got tremendous power. At the same time, we have this tremendous complexity that seems almost too mind-boggling and intricate to ever completely understand. Do you think we'll ever completely understand it?
I don't know that we're going to understand it during the time period that we're talking about here, which is
our
10
lifetime,
or 15 years.
Okay.
I mean, I have my doubts about that. We were talking before the show about, you know, there's the story, and then there's the story behind the story. And you, I don't wonder if we pulled the greatest minds that are working on this right now, if they wouldn't express some doubts as to whether or not really replicating the human brain in computer models is something that we can reasonably achieve in a decade.
That, however, I think is what we are talking about with the Brain Project,
Absolutely.
The Human Brain Project. And you've been following this, Noah, for 6 years as researchers work to create a – I'll have you describe it, but it's essentially a virtual model or map of the brain. How are they doing that?
There are several approaches right now taken by different leading projects in the world. So it's before I talk about that one, it's just important to say this is not the approach. And in fact, it's drawn a lot of criticism because there are people who are using very different methods. So we can get to that in a second. But yes, the Human Brain Project, I started following it first when it was called the Blue Brain Project. It was one group in Lausanne, Switzerland, and they had won some major funding from the Swiss government and from their institution, EPFL, as well as the support of IBM, which is where the blue in the Blue Brain Project comes from, because they were using the blue gene computers. People might know Watson.
Mm-hmm.
So they were using the supercomputing power that IBM afforded them in order to create 3D models, reconstructions of neurons in a virtual environment. So they're taking real data from mouse brains. They're first starting with a mouse, and they're putting that into this virtual simulation and getting down to even the level of molecules, ion channels, things that are, you know, very small pieces of the puzzle. But they put all that into the model in the hopes that if they put enough bottom-up details in all of these interactions, the whole, the 10,000 neuron circuit that they've been working on might start to behave like an actual 10,000 neuron piece of tissue that they would study in a real mouse brain. So it's attempting to be a one-to-one virtual replicate of a biological system. Now, that's been very controversial because people don't know if we actually know enough about
right.
the brain yet, even at that level of molecules and neurons, to be able to do that.
Well, just to give people listening a fundamental understanding of this, I think that the only organism for which we have mapped their entire neural system is a nematode, which has 302 neurons. The human brain has 80 billion with the B and 100 trillion connections between those 80 billion neurons. And they want to do this. They want to map this in 10 years. Now that you've been, or now 15, now that you've been with the project for 6, do you think even 15 is possible?
You know, I'm not going to sit here and predict what's possible or not, because, you know, I did study it as an undergraduate, but I'm not going to pretend to hang with the top minds in the world. However, what I will say is that even the people I've been following who were in the Blue Brain Project, and then they won this major funding, they became the Human Brain Project, which means they brought together over 100 labs in Europe under the same research program. What I can say is that even their rhetoric about what they're doing has changed, and that's captured in my film.
Okay. Portions of that film will be shown when Noah Hutton comes to town on the 14th of April as part of the Central Piedmont Community College Sensoria Arts Festival, which we'll talk about it in some depth a little bit later on in the program. But he'll be speaking at 2 p.m. in Tate Hall, and then at 7:30 p.m. that night in the Halton Theater, and kind of taking two different approaches to this and covering two different areas. When we come back, I want to talk to both Noah and to Dr. Tony Asher about what we'll know if they're able to complete this brain mapping project. What will that tell us? What tools will be in our toolkit that are not there now? It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the Bacon Egg Cheese Biscuit, hardwood smoked bacon, eggs, and cheese on a made-from-scratch biscuit. Available all day at area Bojangles. You know, when Charlotte was debating building light rail, there was a lot of resistance. If you were around then, you certainly remember that. But that isn't something that's particular to this city. Ben Ross discovered that when Washington, D.C. considers transit development, those proposals are opposed by conservatives and liberals alike. So he set out to discover why. And when he did, he uncovered some surprising things. He joins us along with some Charlottians to talk about suburbia, urban planning, social status, and more on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a deadline on nuclear weapons negotiations with Iran, ongoing efforts to slow a Middle Eastern nuclear arms race, and the threat of worldwide nuclear proliferation.
That's the topic of the Diane Rehm Show, coming up next from 10 to noon on listener-funded public radio or 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Noah Hutton, documentarian, writer, composer. He's working on a film that will premiere, if I got them here,
2024.
Is the trailer ready yet? In a world.
That's right.
It's the Blue Brain Project, but he's coming here to Charlotte to talk about the research that's going on as a part of this project and show little snippets of some of the material that he's shot so far in the last 6 years. He'll be part of the CPCC Sensoria Festival. He's coming here on April the 14th with us in our studio. By the way, Noah's in New York. With us in our studio, Dr. Tony Asher is director of the Adult Brain Tumor Program at Carolina's healthcare system. He also works with Novant at Presbyterian Hospital. So when these scientists working all over the world trying to create this virtual brain, this virtual map of the human brain, if they are able to accomplish this, Noah, what do they think will be the end result of it?
Well, in the beginning, they said that it would be a speaking, talking, living being. And in fact, the figure I'm studying, who's the head of the Blue Brain Project and now has been one of the heads of the Human Brain Project, said that in 10 years, when he gave his TED talk to launch this project, he said, in 10 years, I'll send a hologram controlled by the simulation back to give a TED talk for you. So there was an idea in the beginning that this would be a conscious entity, and it would parallel a lot of things you might hear from artificial intelligence discussions. So
when you look him up now, when you look him up in the encyclopedia, you'll find him under Optimist.
Exactly, right. Well, so I thought this is the guy to start making a film about, because no one else was willing to make that kind of promise and still isn't at this moment. Now, even he has scaled back on that promise, and now they talk about it more as what this will be once they've collected all the data and built a full reconstruction is a sort of telescope for the brain where you can zoom into any region, you can look at how the interactions go on in Alzheimer's and schizophrenia in a certain area of the brain, and you might be able to target treatments, surgeries, whatever you need to do to eradicate disease might be easier when you have a full-scale telescope for the brain. So we're not sure anymore if it's going to be a speaking conscious entity, or at right. least that's not really talked about in the same fervor it was to begin with.
How ambitious is – how overly optimistic do you think these predictions are, the initial prediction is? And even if we don't fulfill the initial optimistic prediction, what do you think we'll come away with, Doctor?
Well, I think that, again, it's an incredibly ambitious project, and the individuals who conceived it and are working on it have to be congratulated, Mike. But the idea that they can achieve that in 10 to 15 years, I think, is not likely to occur. However, because there's so much attention around this, because there's so much funding, unquestionably we are going to understand this particular biological system in much greater detail than we did before. And so what is that going to do? That's going to allow us to optimize normal brain function by understanding how the brain works. We're going to be able to improve our ability to correct disorders. And furthermore, the idea that we can create more intelligent information systems that will allow us to solve different problems. You know, one problem that we have using our own brains is that, you know, our processors are only they're limited. One advantage that large supercomputers have is that they can do calculations, for example, much quicker than we can. Mm-hmm. If we were able to supercharge some of those processes, particularly problem-solving capabilities. And on the basis of our understanding of neural networks, it would be a huge advance. So one way or another, this project is going to have a significant yield.
So they're trying to develop, if I understood what I read, they're trying to develop this virtual brain on which they can run, what, test programs to look not only for disease, but to look if this exists, then this will happen, a kind of if-then approach to the brain. Is that accurate, Noah? Is that what's going on?
That's right. You can imagine that you could stitch cause and effect tighter together than you can now when it comes to looking at brain scans, where you're tracking what MRI is tracking is the residue of blood flow to a certain area of the brain. What you can look at if you have a biologically accurate simulation of neural activity is, in real time, what is the neural underpinning of a thought, of a memory, of conscious experience. So that's where the philosophical and implications on the knowledge of yourself and consciousness come into play, in addition to disease and disorder.
Yes, so what Noah is talking about, I think, is really very important. So the idea right now, when I was mentioning earlier that, for example, a functional MRI allows us to tell activity is occurring in a particular part of the brain, what we're really seeing right now is just, if you will, a surrogate for that real activity, where we're seeing increased blood flow, mm-hmm. which we believe correlates with increased neural activity in that area. But it's really an indirect marker. The idea that we can more directly target these processes and understand them, again, at a cellular and molecular level is really very exciting.
But if I understand this right, if they're successful, they'll be able to run this through a kind of computer virtual brain simulation. But to do that, given the complexity of the brain, one would think that you'd have to make a lot of assumptions about what's going to happen between connection one and connection one zillion. So how do we make those assumptions accurately?
Well, I think go ahead.
I was just going to say, in terms of the assumptions, what the project leaders often talk about is they're trying to figure out what is the least amount of information you need to put into the simulation to get the kind of biologically accurate activity that you want. Mm-hmm. So they're not interested in, for example, modeling every single atom of every cell. They want to know if there are principles that they can establish. We really need these theoretical understandings of the brain at a level of principle that we don't have yet. So if you can get those principles built into the system, you might not need to model every single connection in an accurate way. You might be able to make some guesses.
Now, Noah Hutton, you are a filmmaker. Films are visual. What makes this subject matter visual? It's interesting, what makes it visual? Yeah.
No, it's a good question. What makes it visual are the simulations that they've already produced, are these fly-throughs of neural activity where you can see what they've made already, which is not much of a rat brain, but it's still stunning because when you're surrounded by a column of cells in the cortex, even of a rat, you feel like you're flying through space. I mean, it reminds me of what, you know, cartography must have seemed like in the early days of the great explorers, where you're setting out into this great unknown and you're starting to get back these first images. And really, in neuroscience, visual imagery is front and center of any kind of presentation of what's going on, because you're looking at a space that is just being charted for the first time.
I want to come back to this visual aspect, because you've already demonstrated some of the visual aspect of this in Times Square, and you'll be doing it here as well. But first, I want to talk about something that you, doctor, are involved in, because you're kind of involved in the same thing, approaching it from a different angle. You're the director of the National Neurosurgery Quality and Outcomes Database.
That's correct.
A project that you designed to create a national registry where doctors can share their brain and spinal treatment results, and you're using big data. Is this something that's just now possible because of computing power?
Well, I think it's now possible because of computer capabilities that we didn't have, say, 5-10 years ago. I think the bigger issue, Mike, and it's interesting to see how society works sometimes, is this imperative for individuals and groups to show the objective value of what we're doing in healthcare has really pushed this. So the federal government, insurers, patient groups have really demanded this information. And so it's been easier to justify the investment in these huge systems. And so what we've done, and it's very similar to what's being done in other specialties, we've created these systems where we are linking practitioners around the country, folks who, frankly, previously weren't involved in research, weren't involved in science in any direct way, are now all working together to come up with better solutions for healthcare.
These are the frontline people who actually are dealing with patients and not slides in a laboratory.
That's exactly right. You know, so medical science was previously just for the elites. folks in academic centers who had these unique resources to advance science. We're trying to put these tools in the hands of individuals. And interestingly, it's a different type of neural network, right? We're linking all mm-hmm. these brains around the country. And frankly, a lot of folks who haven't been involved before to try and create synergies.
Plus, when you look at big data and you have the ability to analyze big data from all of these different practitioners around the country, it seems to me that at some point you almost have to guarantee that some new information will emerge, some pattern will emerge that will help doctors across the country look at things differently, maybe take new approaches that will work.
There's no question. We're on a couple different levels, Mike. First of all, we're finding that if you look at real world practice, in other words, what people are doing in real everyday care, mm-hmm. not just academic institutions, the results of our care are not quite what we thought. Some ways it's better, some ways it's worse. And so we're identifying opportunities to improve care.
Could this dovetail with this human brain project that Noah Hutton is working on? Or is it going to complement it or augment it in some way?
Well, I think what it will do, again, is show us where our opportunities are. It's going to show us what the state of art is out there in standard medical practice. But I also think we're creating an infrastructure that will allow us to, first of all, disseminate information, but also take some of these insights that are going to be gained in terms of basic science. There inevitably are going to be clinical questions that arise from that. Mm-hmm. So we can more easily reach out into standard practice and say, this is what we're observing in the laboratory. How can we make this relevant in clinical systems?
You are the director of the Adult Brain Tumor Program and co-director of the Neuroscience Institute at Carolina's healthcare system. Obviously, you work with brain cancer and you work with tumors in the brain, sometimes benign. How would a virtual brain, such as the one they're working on in the Human Brain Project, help you in your work?
Well, we're tasked with taking care of lesions that are positioned within various areas of the brain. So we have to be able to get into those areas safely, effect a therapeutic objective, and then get out. So understanding in great detail what is occurring in and around those areas of disease is critically important. It tells us corridors that we can use to safely access a lesion. It tells us how patients are likely to respond to therapies. And so understanding in much better detail than we have right now, what that activity is like around those lesions, Mike, would be extremely helpful.
Because you and Dr. Stuart Burry with Southeast Radiation Oncology conducted a small-scale study on your own about performing radiation therapy prior to taking out a brain tumor that might become the national treatment protocol for patients battling metastatic brain cancer. Would your work have been aided by this brain project, by being able to do this virtually?
I think to a certain extent it would. Our clinical objectives and our research objectives have been, again, to try and minimize the amount of damage that is done to normal functioning brain tissue when we're treating these localized areas of disease. So I would say yes. And I think that it would also probably have reinforced the idea that this, what we call neoadjuvant radiation therapy, is a better way to go because we're minimizing the dose of radiation to normal brain inherently. And also it seems the results are very encouraging because we are decreasing the risk of recurrent brain cancer in and around the areas where we're treating these patients. And so it's been tremendously exciting. Now, whether or not this broader project would inform that, Mike, is hard to know. Mm-hmm. But it would tell us in more detail what is lurking around these lesions that we're treating and how we can avoid those functional areas.
Noah, one of the hopes of the Human Brain Project is that doctors will be able to test theories about how to test for, possibly treat, things like autism and schizophrenia, possibly depression, even Alzheimer's. I'm not a scientist and I'm not a doctor, so I don't know that this is true, but I know that Alzheimer's does leave behind telltale signs. There are plaques in the brain that we know after death and we can do an autopsy and see these in the brain tissue. But do we see the same thing with schizophrenia and depression and autism? And if not, how would this project be able to spot and help treat these conditions?
Well, I think we are starting to identify some of the markers of these other diseases, and schizophrenia, one of the hypotheses is it's a problem in the dopaminergic system. So people have heard about dopamine. It might be an issue in that circuitry in the brain. So if you believe in materialism, if you do believe that all of these things are rooted in the physical structure of the brain, then all of these diseases and disorders have physical markers. Mm-hmm. And a project like this might bring us closer to deciding what we can do to early on in development, perhaps steer an individual away from these telltale signs and to get them to a more quote-unquote healthy state. But in the end, you know, it might lead to targeted treatment for people, yes, who already have disorders and diseases.
Let me come back to something you alluded to a few minutes ago, Noah, and that is we're not just looking for disease. The end result of this project may not just help doctors find disease or find ways to treat disease or even cure brain disease. It gets at the essence of who we are. It gets at how we think, what happens when we have a thought, what happens when we have an emotion, what happens that creates our individual personalities. That's really fascinating, but it's also, it seems to me, fraught with great peril for a lot of people. Do scientists take that into account as they try to work on these things?
You know, they do. I think that everyone's aware that this is a not only a medical question, but a deeply philosophical one. And I think what I hear is that there's a need to integrate ethics at every stage. And the Human Brain Project does have an ethics wing. So it's encouraging to know that that is part of the conversation in this field of neuroethics.
But if we could find out what it is that gives us our individual personality, if we could find out what happens when we think something, where that thought comes from, what would be ethically wrong about discovering that?
Oh, I don't mean that there's anything ethically wrong in discovering that. I just mean in the use of that knowledge. If we have an idea of exactly what physical structure, what pattern of cells firing underlies a memory or a thought, it would be a little worrisome about where that knowledge or technology that could come out of that knowledge might end up. So I just mean that it's good to have ethical panels involved at every step of discovery because you don't want that to end up in nefarious hands.
I lose you in 90 seconds. You've created a visual piece of art called Brain City, which you displayed on the massive screens in Times Square in November, and you're bringing that here to Charlotte during the Novant Health Invitational Criterium on April the 11th. Quickly describe this piece.
This piece was a journey through the human brain that I put together from the latest visuals from four leading projects around the world. So it's not just the Human Brain Project. It's the other ones, which we haven't really talked about much, but there are very different ways of approaching this question, not just virtual modeling, but actual tracing of real tissue and other ways to poke and pry at tissue to understand it. So what I've done is I've taken the visuals from four of these projects. I've woven them together into this journey that also begins and ends with images of the city. So I'm kind of comparing neural landscapes to physical exterior landscapes, because there is some interesting work that's been done that draws that very comparison. The grids of the brain, of fiber pathways in the brain, look eerily similar to the grids of Manhattan. So I was interested in exploring that question a little bit through that piece. And you can see that on the 14th as well.
All right.
On the 11th.
On the 11th of April. Yeah. Noah Hutton will be here on the 14th, but his Brain City will run on the 11th. We'll talk more about that when we come back. I have to let Noah go, but thank you for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
We'll come back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Starworks hosting Firefest, a celebration of fire and art, ceramic sculpture, metal, and hot glass activities for all ages Friday and Saturday in Star, North Carolina. Tickets at starworksnc.org. A deadline on nuclear weapons negotiations with Iran is approaching. Actually, it's past. So on the Diane Rehm Show, they're going to explore ongoing efforts to slow a Middle East nuclear arms race and the threat of nuclear proliferation worldwide. That's coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we're about to delve into the nuts and bolts of Sensoria, the arts festival at CPCC that we've been talking peripherally about. Stay with us for that.
Mm. Morning Edition is awake around the clock to bring you the latest news.
It's 2:10 in the morning, so still 5 hours left.
The hosts are usually here around 3:30.
You have Ophibia at 4,
uh-huh.
And it's about the Boko Haram ISIS news over the weekend.
Crunch time is 4 a.m.
Until 5 when the show starts.
Hit it. Open.
Good morning, I'm David Green. With
Morning Edition. Up all night to bring you all you need to know. Listen every weekday.
Morning Edition from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Noah Hutton, documentary filmmaker, will be with us here in Charlotte on the 14th of April for two talks, one at Tate Hall, one at the Halton Theater, both at CPCC. They're upstairs, downstairs from each other. That's all part of the Sensoria Arts Festival, which we're about to talk about. Dr. Tony Ash has been in our studio for the whole time here. He's the Adult Brain and Spinal Cord Tumor Program Director and the co-medical director of the Neuroscience Institute at the Carolinas Healthcare Systems. You're also involved at Novant, and Novant is one of the sponsors of this criterium that we alluded to a second ago with Noah Hutton, because his piece is a art piece, visual art piece called Brain City, will be projected on the walls of the Old Carolina Theater at 6th and Tryon from 6 to 10 p.m. on April the 11th. Why is the hospital involved in the criterium?
Well, the hospital is supporting a very important cause, which is awareness of brain tumors and also support of brain tumor research. And the criterium has really been the key element in raising funds over the last several years. It's a fantastic event. It's the largest criterium cycling event in the country, the largest purse, and we typically get anywhere between 20, 30,000 individuals out watching that race. It's a very exciting thing. Great vehicle to allow for individuals to understand what the impact of brain cancer is.
Before we talk more about Sensoria, and we're about to do that, I want to follow up on something you were talking to me about off the air a second ago,
sure.
And that is the understanding of what you call the eloquent functions of the brain and what our improving our understanding of that might be able to do for not only doctors but for patients.
Well, you know, all brain functions are important, Mike, but when we talk about eloquent functions, we're talking about those things that really make us human, our ability to reason, communicate, be involved in complex motor tasks. Understanding where these areas are is extremely important, how they function, how they interconnect. Right now, we have these very gross ways of looking at them. We talked a little earlier in the program about functional MRI and just seeing these areas light up. It's really just increased blood flow. But if we could understand better how these areas are connected, how they interact, we're going to be able to tailor our therapies in a much more intelligent way going forward. Mm. So right now, I think we do a reasonable job avoiding those major areas. Going forward, I think we can really improve the quality of life of our patients if we understand these systems in much greater detail.
You've been studying the brain for your entire adult life, I would guess, because you are such an expert on tumors. But I have thought about this a lot. And I just want to get your take on it.
Sure.
We have these conversations in real life every day with people. Mm-hmm. We don't anticipate what we're going to say. I have these conversations on the radio with people. I ask people questions, and they don't know what I'm going to ask. And suddenly, they have to come up with an answer. Is that not astounding that we can do that?
I think that just lifting up this pen from the table is astounding that we can do that. I mean, and the idea that if, for example, if I close my eyes, I would know that this is a pen is an absolute miracle. So the simplest things that we do, the simplest things that we take for granted are amazing. And if you break those down mm-hmm. on the cellular and molecular level, the complexity is fantastic.
I mean, you're not thinking about what you're saying. It's just coming out.
That's exactly
That's
right.
That's what's so fascinating yeah. to me about it.
I mean, amazing.
It's just astounding to me. Well, that's a topic for a whole nother show.
Exactly.
As we mentioned, Noah Hutton is going to be speaking at two events about the Human Brain Project and his film documenting its progress, the Blue Brain Project, during CPCC's upcoming Sensoria Arts Festival. But wait, this is a film about science, so how does it fit into an arts festival? Let's find out. Amy Bagwell is an English instructor at Central Piedmont Community College, but she's also an organizer of the festival and also the author of a number of books on poetry. Welcome to the program. Thanks for sitting here for so long and not saying anything.
Thanks. No, this is fascinating.
For those who may not know, what is Sensoria?
Sensoria is a festival of the arts at CP, and it started 23 years ago, believe it or not.
Really? That long ago?
As a literary festival, Irene Honeycutt started it and brought just world-class writers to the school. And over the years, with all of our arts programming, we realized we need to expand this mm-hmm. beyond literature. And so now it includes opera, theater, music, drama, history, culinary programs, and film, which is why Noah is coming.
I talked to Alfred Urey, on this program as a part of Sensoria several years ago.
Brilliant.
Fascinating conversation. Really big-time people have come here because of Sensoria. But you have really expanded this since it began 23 years ago. You have 80 events
80.
Scheduled.
Mm-hmm.
That's astounding.
It is. We don't sleep. and 12,000, I think we had 12,000 visitors last year. So it's a big festival. It's a big effort for our students and for the community. And it's a way, you know, I love this conversation, which is all about connection, this neural network that you were talking about, Noah's metaphor with Brain City. Our school is a big brain. You know, we're all connected in this way. And siloing, as Noah mentioned, this highly specialized world makes no sense. Bringing things together makes sense.
Is that why this filmmaker who's doing a documentary on a science project, essentially, it fits into an arts festival?
Yes.
How did you find out about him, and how did you decide that it fit into an arts festival?
His agent mentioned him to one of my deans, Melissa Vrana, and Melissa fell in love with the idea. And when we saw that Noah had done these projections in Times Square, you know, I have a sickness for walls. I'm kind of obsessed with walls and poetry. And I said, we need to project this in Charlotte. Why not? We booked Noah. We got super excited. Our film people are thrilled because we have a new associate's program in broadcasting and production technology.
Digital media. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so with the facilities we have at WTVI, our students are going to be able to get this real, actual training and exposure mm-hmm. so that they can be prepared for further school or for careers, and so that they can make good decisions about what they're doing. Do I want to do this? Do I like this? I love this. How do I do this?
I have one word for them.
What?
Run.
Run. I'll pass that on. So we wanted to do this projection, and we reached out to Charlotte Center City Partners and said, here's this 3-minute film. Would you like to help us show this? And they jumped in with both feet, and Robert Crumbine and Lynn Henderson said, yes, absolutely. So that's how that happened, because Robert connected Noah's appearance with the Criterium and said, look at this. Look how well these dovetail.
Wow.
And so they are sponsoring. They are manning. They are making it happen. The projection of this film on that wall, which elevates everyone's efforts that are happening in that, you know, 4 or 5 day period.
You mentioned that you have this fascination with walls and with poetry, and you've somehow been able to pull those. And I don't know that this is, well, that's a pager going off. We have a doctor in the house.
It's not me.
You've somehow been able to put this to work across town, and I didn't even know it was going on, and I pass one of these installations every single day. It is the one on the old, I didn't even know this place had a name, Treelore House, which is on 7th Street, just mm-hmm. down the street mm-hmm. from our Spirit Square studio. The mm-hmm. other one that I passed every day is on what used to be the Dixie Tavern.
Yes.
The one on the Treelore House appears at a distance, at least, to be a series of photographs of people's faces set on a background of great big dots, which I suppose you could look at as being the, if you got really tight on a newspaper photograph, mm-hmm. you would see the dots that compose the photograph. Mm-hmm. I don't think there are any words in that. There are words on the Dixie Tavern. So tell me how this all works as an art project.
Right. The Treelore House project was a collaboration with JR's, the international artist JR's Inside Out 11 Million project, and with Latin American Coalition. And so what we did was Levine Properties had given us the space on the walls. They wanted to do something to increase sort of awareness and acknowledgement of the fact that we all come from somewhere. So we worked to provide a poem and to install it all. Unfortunately, it couldn't stay forever because it was wheat pasted, but we are putting a permanent poem on that mm-hmm. building, so that'll be exciting.
You've
Again,
got,
connections. It's
see,
all about connections.
Another thing that you've got, another installation in this art on the, on this poetry on and art on the walls project that you've been instrumental in is on a newsstand near mm. the library mm. downtown. That's not a wall. It's a newsstand. It's where the on one side you pull the papers
right.
out. On
right.
the other side is this line of poetry.
Right, where you might expect advertising. There's
well,
a
yes,
bit of
why
poem.
Poetry on walls? What's that all about?
Well, and I love that you bring that up because that was designed by the one you're speaking of. It's a Tony Abbott, an excerpt from a Tony Abbott poem, and the design for that was created by a CPCC graphic design student named Jacob Mead. And so And that is another collaboration with Charlotte Center City Partners. So back to this connections idea. In short, we do this project because people deserve access to poetry. Mm. And it's too small. It's too high shelf. It's too removed, in my opinion, which is also why we do this arts festival. You know, we have the best students, I think. I'm kind of biased, but we have the best students in the world, and they deserve Pulitzer Prize winners. They deserve U.S. Poets Laureate. They deserve access to Noah Hutton talking about this brain mapping project. They deserve to sit there and ask him incredible questions. Yeah. So it's all, to me, it all comes back to the same thing.
So let's talk, because there's a wide variety of things that you offer every year as part of this festival, and you're doing it again this year. And the festival, by the way, runs, what, April the
10th to the 18th? 10th to the 18th, I think.
It's a long time.
It is.
One of the things you're offering, and it's everything from theater to art to, yes. to literature to in this case, opera.
Yes.
Because you're having, we're very familiar with the concept of the Battle of the Bands.
Yes.
But you're having a battle of the composers between an Italian composer, Giuseppe Verdi, which is Joe Green in English, and the German composer, Richard Wagner, which in English is Richard Wagner. Why the two of them? Why this battle of the operatic composers?
I'm going to pull my best teacher move and say, I don't know, because it's important to acknowledge what you do and don't know. I do know that... we will have for these performances, Alan Yamamoto, who's our division director for arts, tells me there will be 120 performers on stage from CPCC opera, orchestra, choruses, and soloists. And they're performing a series of very famous choruses in this. And I think my guess, and Alan might disagree, but my guess is that this is a really good way to demonstrate in small bits some of this work. You know, with so you get exposure to a number of important pieces and to two very different composers.
You get the greatest hits.
I would guess.
You put the greatest hits of Giuseppe Verdi up against Wagner and you see who wins.
Powerful and interesting for sure. And performed by students.
What happens if there's a tie? I'm just kidding. in terms, there's more music on the program too because you are bringing, you're doing a collaboration with the Beckler Museum of Modern Art, and you're bringing in art and masterpieces of music from the 20th century.
Yes, 20th century music, and Craig Bove is sort of running with that. And with masterpieces, again, from modern art and contemporary music, you know, there are these connections. You think art doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, someone who's painting is also probably aware of what's going on in music and is influenced by the same things that are happening at this moment that the musician, the composer, the sculptor, you know, is influenced by. And so these things taken together make for a greater understanding of the context from which they come. And I think that's part of why we share art, right? So, you know, you're talking about all of these connections between art and neuroscience and this beautiful idea Dr. Asher mentioned of the, what was it, eloquent functions of the brain and the miracle that you two were talking about of speech and how we communicate without thinking. And Chris Abani, who's a Nigerian fiction writer and poet who will be at the festival the Wednesday, the 15th, he's a former political prisoner in Nigeria for his writing. He talks about that a lot, but what he focuses on is, sure, there are horrors in the world, but what connects us? Mm-hmm. Is the important thing. Where's the common ground? Where do we meet in the middle? How beautiful that is, and how beautiful it is that we have a language that allows us to find each other, you know? And so there are all of these ways that art, science, you know, even sports, we don't have to just like one or the other. And so bringing all of this together in this mad rush of a festival, to me, makes sense.
You know, we don't understand why we like what we like and why we don't like what we don't like. But all of that is up here. It's in the brain, correct?
Correct.
And if you like college basketball, but you also like Mozart, there's no explaining that. But it makes sense to bring them all together, it seems to me, in one place at one time, correct?
Oh, I think so. I mean, Amy and I were talking before the show about, you know, the idea that this neural network trying to understand that better. I mean, such a fantastic metaphor for all these interconnected systems, and or rather any complex system of interconnections, whether societal or art or philosophy. I mean, it's a great way to just start a conversation. And the idea that we can visually represent these networks, you know, is very appealing also. It's just a great theme in which to talk about a lot of ways that we interact as individuals.
Yeah, I loved your analogy of the neural network that takes place at a festival like this, because you have people on the stage from different backgrounds. You have people in the audience or participants from different backgrounds, all being exposed to things that perhaps they'd never been exposed to.
Right.
And talking to each other about all these things, and you've got this massive super brain on campus.
Right, exactly.
Doing all this stuff. There are 80 events. That's a lot. Nobody can take in all of these events, but how do you find out what's going on, when, where, how, why, and how much of this? How much does it cost?
Great questions. Thank you. Those I can answer. The website, sensoria.cpcc.edu, that's where you want to go for the full schedule. And you can look at it in chronological order, and you can also select your area of particular interest. I just want to see the history events. I just want to see the literary events, whatever you'd like to look at. All the performances are very, very inexpensive. All the speakers are free. All events are open to the public.
Wow. And there's a theater piece in there, too, by the guy who wrote Fences.
Yes, August Wilson.
August Wilson. Where is it? Right here. Joe Turner's Come and Gone.
Yes.
Which is April 10th through April the 19th. Amy Bagwell is one of the organizers of the CPCC Sensoria Festival of the Arts, April 10th through 18th at Central Piedmont. Dr. Tony Asher is director of the Adult Brain Tumor Program and co-medical director of the Neuroscience Institute at Carolina's Healthcare Systems. I want to thank you for being here for the whole hour. And Noah Hutton will be back in town on the 14th at Tate Hall and the Halton Theater for Sensoria to talk about his film about the Human Brain Project. Thank you all.
Thank you, Mike.
Charlotte.